Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk with people from Ohio with an interesting story to tell. Columbus is diversifying rapidly, with minority populations increasing every year. But are our lawmakers and state legislature keeping up with the changes? Ohio Representative Munira Abdullahi represents this change. She's the first Muslim woman, the first Somali woman, and one of the youngest Democratic members. Welcome to All Sides, Representative Abdullahi.
Thank you for having me.
So lawmakers just passed the bill that overhauls higher education, known as Senate Bill 1. During testimony, you brought up a lot of concerns, especially one about how many students were vocally against the bill. Do you anticipate this bill being signed by Governor DeWine?
I'm really trying to be optimistic that Governor DeWine shows that he cares for students and he cares for the young people and the future of young people in Ohio and vetoes it. And it's not without precedent. He's done it in the past where he's gone around the majority and vetoed very harmful bills that would be harmful to young people, because he does say that he cares about the younger generation. And so I'm staying optimistic, and I'm hoping and I'm asking and imploring Governor DeWine to veto this bill.
Now, this bill has been one of the most contentious pieces of legislation in recent memory. What did you think of how many people actually submitted testimony and actually came to the State House about this?
It was honestly very shocking to see the amount of people that came in, and then for us to, for the legislature, the majority, to really turn around and just say it doesn't, like, their voices don't matter. I believe there was almost 1,000 people who testified in the Senate. When you add the House opponent testimonies, it's about 1,000. And then proponents, people who testified for it, less than 100, maybe 50. And so the majority of individuals that came into the House testified against it. We got thousands more calls and emails about voting against SB1. And so the number of people opposing this bill is incredible.
Now, you're being optimistic for him to veto
it.
But assuming he signs it sometime in the next 10 days, because it's on his desk now, how will you work in your position, in your role, to try to do things behind the scenes, maybe make a few changes if you disagree so much with this legislation? Is there a piece or a part of it that you think you can do and you can work on in a different way?
I mean, we're still trying to strategize and think of ways that we can minimize the damage of it. However, once it's signed into law, I guess the only option after this is to really take it to the courts, because this bill affects so many parts of the university, right? It affects minority scholarships, it affects DEI, it affects professor tenure, it affects faculty strikes. And so at least, you know, at least the faculty strikes piece, we might be able to take that to court. The scholarship piece, because this affects private donor dollars. And so they should be allowed to use their funds how they see fit, right? And so some of these things, we're trying to see what we can take to the courts if it gets passed in law. And see how can we minimize the damage to students.
Now, you mentioned the DEI programs. How has elimination of DEI programs impacted your work?
It's been really sad to see. I went to Ohio State University, and I have, you know, sisters. I'm the oldest of nine, so I've got a lot of sisters.
A lot of sisters, all right.
Who have gone to university, who are still in university. And so just seeing that the dismantling of these institutional departments that were created to make them feel safer, to make them feel included, especially in a university like Ohio State, where the majority is not diverse, right? And so just watching it and seeing how these students are affected has been really hurtful for me. And it pains me that I can't do more to help them. And so I just try to reach out to university students and see what I can do to support them and make them feel safer on their campuses and make them feel more welcome in Ohio.
There's been a lot of rhetoric, I mean, all the way up to former Vice President Kamala Harris, about minority women being elected or hired as DEI hires. Have you witnessed that or talked about that in your role in the State House?
Yeah. It's really wild to, you know, imply that when it takes so much more, takes so much more out of minority women to get into these spaces, right? Take me, for example. There's never been a Muslim woman in the Ohio State House. It did not happen on accident, right? It took a lot of work. You know, that statistic of even just general women running for office takes them seven times to run for office, and they have to work twice as hard as a man, right? There's people have preconceived notions about you and where you come from, and so you have to work a lot harder than everyone else in that space. And so it's really comical for me when they say, oh, DEI hire, as if, you know, this woman did not have to work three times, four times as hard to get here as their male counterparts.
Well, you said you went to Ohio State, right?
Yes.
What did you study there?
I studied international relations and diplomacy.
Okay. Did you have aspirations? Were you going to run for office?
No.
Or did you get asked a million times?
I got asked a million times. Yeah. I was thinking of going to the UN or a State Department. I was really passionate about world peace. And I, at the same time, I was volunteering in my community, and I was a community organizer, like my parents. And, you know, just noticing just how much work that we do in our nonprofits that is really just trying to put a Band-Aid on bad policy. And trying to figure out what I can do more to fix that. And people started asking me, why don't you just run for office? And I was like, you know what? Why not?
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk with people from Ohio with an interesting story to tell. And we're talking today with Ohio Representative Munira Abdullahi. Recently, at least three Muslim college students who are legally in the country have been detained. The most recent one co-wrote an op-ed piece for a Tufts newspaper. Are you worried about college students speaking out, protesting, and being targeted for arrest or even deportation?
Yeah, I mean, I was worried before, and now I'm petrified as we see the consequences of speaking out with these three students. It's their constitutional right to speak out against injustices or what they believe to be injustices. And for them to be using their First Amendment right and then being targeted because of it is very scary. It's a very terrifying thing to see. And I don't want to discourage students from speaking out, right? It's been student movements historically that have created positive change in society. And so their work is really important, and them being able to speak up is really important. However, with this administration, we've seen, a slow descent into fascism. Because if it's students today, who's next tomorrow, right? It's a green card holder today, right? Who's next, right? It could be the jump from green card holder to American citizen is not a huge leap to make. And so it's very concerning, not only for these students, but really just Americans in general and America in general, because what we stood for, right, was freedom of speech, the liberty to speak up and speak out. And now that is all in danger.
Are you hearing from people who are asking you, like, should I stop protesting? Should I go behind the scenes? Are they asking for your advice in that way?
Yeah. I mean, I was hearing that before this happened, and now it's definitely increasing. I honestly don't even know what to tell them, because on one hand, I want them to continue speaking. I want them to continue fighting back, because once we acquiesce to fascism, that's when fascism grows. And so, but at the same time, I don't want anyone to be in danger and anyone to be in harm's way. And so really trying to brainstorm with community activists and organizers and students on how, they could still practice their First Amendment right and still be safe.
We interviewed Ohio State President Ted Carter yesterday, and I asked him about this, and he did not seem worried about students on campus being arrested or their student visas being at risk. He said, unless they commit a crime. Do you agree with that? Do you think that because some of these examples we're seeing are not crimes, yeah?
Right. I mean, we've already seen it happen, so mm-hmm. I don't know why he's not worried about it. Mm-hmm. We've seen Mahmoud Khalil, and the most recent is Rumaysa Ozturk, I believe, who just wrote an op-ed, and she was essentially kidnapped on the street by ICE agents wearing plain clothes. So there is a danger. He should be more afraid. He should be more worried about these students. And he should be doing a lot more to protect them on campus as well. And I would like to see a statement from OSU, stating that they will protect their students against ICE and any actions like what happened to Rumaysa Ozturk and Mahmoud Khalil.
Now, we mentioned earlier Senate Bill 1 and talking with Governor DeWine about vetoing it. Besides Senate Bill 1, we'll set that aside for a second, even though it's a huge piece of legislation. Can you tell me what some of your top priorities are in your position in your second term?
Yes. A lot of them are similar to what I had as top priorities my first term, but now I know more, so I'm able to work on it better. And that includes affordable health care. So I'm a type 1 diabetic. And I have a family who take life-saving medication. And a lot of times, it's so sad to see how expensive these medications can get, and seeing folks having to choose between, life-saving medication or their daily expenses. And so cutting the cost of medication like insulin, inhalers, that's a huge focus of mine this GA, and it was last GA. The other piece is economic justice, so cutting costs for people. Right now, we're working on a bill that bans junk fees. So all those random fees when you're purchasing things that make it hard for you to budget, there's a couple more. There's a lot more, but mm-hmm. that's pretty much the gist of it. Economic justice, medication affordability. I would say those are probably the two buckets that I'm working on.
Now, do you feel like the Republicans have a significant majority in mm-hmm. both the House and Senate? Do you feel like they are listening and wanting to sign on to some of these pieces of legislation that the Democrats and you want to put forward?
A couple of them, yeah. For my insulin bill, last year when I dropped it, it was right after I learned very quickly, right within my 2 months, that I needed to have a Republican on the legislation for it to start moving. And so I was lucky and fortunate to find Rep Hall, which actually I think we did an interview here about it, mm-hmm. Who is a Republican counterpart, about the same age. And he also has diabetes. And we collaborated and we worked on this legislation. We're dropping it again this year. And so trying to find common ground with Republicans and seeing what they can work on. The other bill is right to repair for farmers. And so I'm trying to work with a Republican legislator who's also a farmer. And so finding ways to work across the aisle is very important, as we are in the super minority and we probably won't be able to get anything done without them.
Mm. As the first Somali woman in the Ohio House, how do you feel your role is shaping your representation of underrepresented communities?
I think, well, for me, it's definitely showing young Somali women and young Somali boys that this is possible. It's one of the, I guess, pleasures of being in this position. Whenever I go to an event or speak somewhere, there's always like young Somali men and women, young Muslim men and women who are coming up to me and saying, wow, you're such an inspiration. And I was in engineering and now I want to be in politics, or I was in med school and now I want to be in politics. And so it's clear they're starting to see themselves in me. And it's been really powerful to see that. And that's probably been the best part of this job.
And you said you have 9 siblings. Is that what?
Yes. Yes. Well, eight. There's nine.
Oh, eight.
Total.
There's
eight girls. The youngest is a boy.
Wow. All right.
I know. It's wild.
So are
not
they?
The oldest.
You're the oldest?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a lot of pressure. Oldest daughter.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you have the oldest daughter syndrome going on a lot.
oldest daughter syndrome in every way possible.
So those younger eight siblings, are they interested in politics?
I would say one of them is, at least. The others are very activist oriented. Like, they're very engaged in the community. Like I said, both my parents are very active in the community, and they try to do what they can and fill whatever gaps they see. And so we kind of took after them in that way. And now that I'm in politics, the others are starting to get more politically engaged. My little brother like wakes up and goes, "Have you seen what they've done in Washington D.C.?" I'm like, where did you see this? But yeah, they're getting a lot more politically engaged.
Are you, here in Ohio, Republicans have the supermajority, like you mentioned. Are you feeling more optimistic in the future when you look toward your eight younger siblings or the rest of the Muslim community that you talk to? Do you feel like we're going to be increasing and in having minority representation? Is it going to grow in coming years? Are you optimistic there?
Well, I'm trying to be optimistic. I mean, we see what's happening right across the country. Things are not looking too hot, to say the least. But, I'm trying to stay optimistic. And I think, especially the younger generation is really aware of a lot of things that are going on. They're honestly hyper aware, right? And they're very active. So Gen Z gives me hope, I would say. And their ability to fight for justice and their ability to speak up and understand very nuanced things about the world. And so I'm optimistic about the younger generation at least like changing things and making it better.
So you're in your second term as a representative. Do you see this as a stepping stone? What do you have aspirations in the future? Big picture?
I don't know. I mean, like I said, I didn't have aspirations for this, and like politics is a whole new thing for me. I have no idea. I'm looking for, where can I put the most effort in, and where can I make the most difference? I'm all about efficiency. Like, if I see that I'm not making a huge difference in one space, I'm going to look for the next space. So I'm always trying to find which space can I be in to make the most difference.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. That was Ohio Representative Munira Abdullahi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk with a woman from Utica, Ohio, a cat lover and a cat rescuer. That's when All Sides continues with Fascinating Ohio on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, It's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Sides with Amy Jurevich, and this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we meet interesting people from the Buckeye State with a good story to tell. And when it comes to pets, some people prefer dogs, while others prefer cats. Before moving to Utica, Ohio, Nicole Stevens didn't have a preference. However, over the last 4 years, she has found her life becoming overrun by cats. It's also given her a new purpose in life, rescuing stray and feral cats. And now she's working to turn her love for cats into a business. Nicole Stevens, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what made you decide that you wanted to open your home to cats, stray cats in your area?
Well, that's a funny story. I'd never had a cat before in my life, never had a desire to have a cat. And I ended up actually babysitting or dog sitting for my niece while she was out of town, and she had just gotten a kitten. Well, that kitten is now mine because I ended up falling in love with the kitten, and he's currently mine. During the, I don't know, I would say about a year after I had him, I started noticing the need around our village here for rescues, because there's tons of alley cats, I guess, for lack of a better term, that are all over our village. And there was a need to get them spayed and neutered because they just continue to repopulate. And while having cats and doing this rescue, I noticed they populate about every 3 months. So
that's a lot of cats. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the first cat you had, what's the name of your first cat?
Tigger.
Tigger. And so do you still have Tigger?
I do. He's a brat.
Well, you keep adding friends to his life, right?
Right. Yeah. That's probably why he turned so bratty. But
so how many cats do you have now?
I have a lot.
more than you can count to call your own?
Yeah, I am. Because I had to stop taking in so many because I don't have the capacity in my house. I have a 2-story farmhouse, but, you know, it gets cramped rather quickly when you have a lot of cats. But I also have several that are outside that don't want to be in a house. So I made a little room for them in my garage so that they could stay warm and sheltered from the storms.
So the idea of bringing these cats in, you said that you were just seeing a lot. Like once you had your first cat, it caused you to notice more cats around your area.
Yes.
Do you feel like the feral cats, I mean, are they everywhere, or is there a particular thing about Utica that they have a lot?
I'm pretty sure they're everywhere. As I've been during my escapade here, I've run into, you know, different people, and I've been setting up down at our little festivals and stuff, trying to get people to update them about, you know, what trap, neuter, and release program is, so that we can get the community involved to get these strays spayed and neutered so that they're not continuously overpopulating the area. And I've ran into, you know, people all around that are saying they have a huge population where they live. So I don't believe it's just this town. And I've joined groups on Facebook and found it's pretty much everywhere. It's like an epidemic. They're just, more people need to get involved. You know, if they don't want a cat, they could at least get involved to help get them spayed and neutered.
Now, are you paying out of your own pocket to get all these cats spayed and neutered?
Yes, currently I am. And here recently, I met a lady, her name is Karen. She's from the Hope Foundation. She actually helped me get 6 of the kittens spayed and neutered. So I greatly appreciate Karen. I love her to pieces for the help, because it's been, you know, when it's coming out of your own pocket, it gets expensive real quick.
Well, I can imagine also feeding them and the litter boxes and everything is coming out of your pocket too then, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So you have a selfless love for cats, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I kind of turned into that. I never thought I would ever own a cat, let alone have a rescue.
Now, you're hoping to, or planning to, expand your cat care operation into an actual cat cafe. Tell me about that.
So I, I never really thought I had a purpose in life, and I've been praying about that and praying about it. And then the Lord dropped on my heart to, you know, this would be something that would help draw more people. And I can also, you know, create it as a ministry as well to reach people. So I want to, my hope and my dream is to have a, build a pole barn and have a sanctuary for the cats so I don't have to turn anybody away, and also have like a restaurant cafe so that it could help with the expenses of things.
So if you, do you already have, I noticed you have a website, you already have a name for your cat cafe that you're hoping to open?
Yes. What? Healing Hearts Cat Cafe.
Healing Hearts Cat Cafe?
Yes.
That's wonderful. And so right now you're just kind of like in the grassroots stage, right? You're trying to find a place and figure out how to open one of these things.
Pretty much. Yes.
Have you driven around Ohio? There's a cat cafe kind of near where I live here in Columbus. Have you been to a few?
There's 3 actually in Columbus, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then we got one close to me in Zanesville as well. And they just opened one. Whiskas just opened one in Granville.
So what would you want yours to look like whenever you look at those other ones? Like if you just dream your biggest dream.
So my hope is to have like not just the cafe for the coffee and little little knickknack sandwiches or whatever. My dream is to have like an actual restaurant. So, you know, and of course I've talked to the health department and everything. We would have to have a system to where the cats would not be able to get into the restaurant. But also I think that would help with getting the community more involved and also helping with the expenses for the cats, you know, because the vet is quite expensive. And then, like you said, the cat and litter box, or the cat food and litter boxes, are quite expensive. But my dream is to have a big pole barn, you know, a large size pole barn, so that we would have plenty of space for the rescues and we wouldn't have to turn anybody away.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and we're talking with Nicole Stevens, who rescues cats and is working toward opening her own cat cafe in her home in Utica. Now, the cats that you currently have, are you trying to get them into permanent homes? Do you consider yourself a foster, or do you consider yourself owning all of them?
I would consider myself a foster, because I have over 20, so I don't want to keep all them. No.
So how do you go about trying to, do you set up a table and say, cats for sale?
So I have set up down at, like I said, our little festivals. And then when we have like little community yard sales, I got pictures and stuff, but I also have a Facebook page. I post them on there. I'm trying to figure out the website because I don't quite understand how we're supposed to add the pictures to the website, but we've been trying to figure that out on the website we created. So I'm not a very techie person, so it may take a little while for that.
That's okay. You're a cat person, not a techie person, right? Now. Got it. Whenever you take in these cats, when you find them, are they healthy or are they sick?
The majority of them have been sick. So I've had several that had, you know, they had worms, ear mites. I've had a few that had Giardia, which I never even knew what that was.
I don't think I know what that is.
You don't know what the, so it's apparently a parasite that is very contagious to animals and humans. Mm. Basically, they get it from drinking dirty water.
So how do you help these sick cats? Again, this is out of your own pocket. You're taking them to the vet?
Yes. So I have cages that I put them in to quarantine them. I have a room that I actually use for my office because I also work a full-time job. So I will lock them in here if I need to quarantine them or in the cage. And then I get their medicine from the vet and hope for the best.
Have you reached out to your community or like the township that you live in for any
yes.
help? Yeah. What's the response been?
So they have been fabulous. I've went to a couple town meetings and spoke with our city administrator, and he's been extremely helpful and, you know, let me know if I needed anything, that he would do what he could to help. So he's been extremely helpful with that.
Okay. So, I mean, because you're basically providing a service for Utica by getting all of these cats spayed and neutered. You're doing a service for the cat population.
Yes. Well, and I found out, too, there's a couple other people that don't actually live in Utica. Well, there's a girl that does. She helps trap them. There's a couple people in Utica that actually help trap the cats to get them spayed and neutered. And there's a lady in Martinsburg. She runs the Rock Foundation, or Rural Ohio Cats and Kittens, that she also gets spayed and neutered as well. So.
Do you name them all when you bring them in?
So when you take them to the vet, they prefer you to have a name. Mm. So I don't typically name them all at first, but then once I take them to the vet, they like to have a name so that they can keep them separated and know which one's which.
Tell me a few of the names that you've picked besides Tigger is your original, right?
Yes. And then I have, I just got two more. Well, I had three kittens, but one of them passed away. They were found in a dirty drain pipe on a construction site. I named them Sophia and Jasmine. And then I have a tiny one that was found, I believe it was the day she was born, which is on September 1st. She's 5 months old, but she's still really tiny, so I call her Itty Bitty. And she just heard me, so she's gone too.
Do they all get along, or do you have to keep them in certain sections of your house?
Are you still there?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think there we go. We lost you for
a
second.
Yeah, sorry. My little itty bitty just jumped on the. Sorry about that.
On the computer?
Laptop.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's perfect. A cat joining our Zoom call just seems appropriate for this conversation. I was asking if they all get along.
For the most part. I have one that I named Leo. He was the one that was the worst off when I found him. I had somebody from the community call me and let me know there was a cat laying under their bush that looked like it was just going to lay there and die. And it was like really cold. So I call him Little Leo because he thinks he's a lion.
Mm.
So he sometimes will test everybody and just walk up to him and try to intimidate him. But, and then Tigger, he has been, I had another cat just show up in my yard who was missing an eye. He likes to intimidate him and wants to fight him a lot. So, you know, for the most part, they get along, but there's occasions where you'll hear a little meow. So
so are you known in your neighborhood, in your town, that you're the cat lady? And if someone has they know to call you?
Yes.
Did you?
Which is fortunate and unfortunate all at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's nice for people to know there's somewhere that they know. I know someone who can help, right? That kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you're not just like a cat caretaker. I mean, you're basically, you're working to save their lives.
Yeah. Some of them, yeah.
So can you tell me how doing this over the past few years, bringing these cats in and helping them, how has it changed you?
Wow. I've heard a lot of people say it, and it may sound cliche, but they really do rescue you as well, because, you know, I didn't realize, one, how much I was missing out on these cats. They all have their own personality, their own little, you know, quirkiness about them, but they've taught me how to be patient. They've taught me how to, you know, what love really is. I mean, I've seen them, there's several of them that have bonded together, and they have a friendship like no other. Like, they're grooming each other and loving on one another, and they come up to me and they want love and affection, and they show me, you know, what is actually unconditional love.
Hmm. Well, I want to wish you good luck with building your Healing Hearts Cafe and your pole barn. I hope you succeed in both of those projects. If someone's listening right now and they want to help you or reach out to you about either of those projects, how can they get in touch?
So I have a Facebook page. It's Healing Hearts Cat Cafe. They can reach me through the Facebook page or via Messenger. It's attached to my Facebook. They can also reach me. I don't know if my phone number is on my Facebook or not, but
well, that's up to you if you want to give out your phone number on the radio, or you can just have them, you know, visit your Facebook page or your website. Yeah,
the website's healingheartscatcafe.com, and then but we haven't really been monitoring it because we're trying to figure out how to get it set up. It's been rather challenging. I thought it would be easier than what it was, but it's not. And then, you know, of course, the Healing Hearts Cat Cafe through the Facebook page or the Messenger.
Well, maybe you'll get lucky. We'll have a listener right here who's tech savvy and is going to reach out to you and willing to help you with your website, too.
That would be awesome.
Well, I wish you so much luck. Good luck opening your Healing Hearts Cafe. And thank you for your time. And we've been talking with Nicole Stevens, who rescues cats and is working toward opening her own cat cafe. Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Amy. Have a great day.
And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU that shares interesting stories about friends and neighbors around Ohio. Thank you for listening. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk with people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. In her unflinching memoir, Patricia Wynn Brown of Columbus reveals a chaotic childhood shaped by her father's World War II experience and PTSD. It's a message of intergenerational trauma told with sensitivity and humor that she knows that others can relate to. And it's a message she plans to bring to others in April at a keynote address at the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. She joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Pat.
Thanks so much, and it's so good to see you again.
It's so great to have you here.
Thank you.
Your memoir is called Royal Roots, Reimagining a Life Through Humor, a Castle, and the U.S. Navy. Now, we know much more about PTSD and its impact on veterans than we did decades ago when you were growing up. But it is becoming clearer now that PTSD also affects families and children. Is that what your book is about?
It is. And it's about my childhood of growing up on the hilltop. And it was right after World War II. So we were the baby boom generation. And most of the fathers in my classes at school were in the war. Mm. But it seemed to me that it was probably not true, that my dad was the only one who had what they called then shell shock, but is now PTSD. And we were in a working class neighborhood, but my dad didn't work. I never saw my dad go to work. And he would be in and out of the VA for long stretches of time when he'd have his episodes. So our life was a bit chaotic with that. And our mother had to keep the boat afloat for four kids, which she did, and got us through.
Now, your father served in the U.S. Navy for several years without incident, but you learned about a massive explosion in 1943. And you think that pinpoints the start of his mental unraveling?
I do, because he served without incident for 7 years. And then as soon as this, all we knew was some explosion. That's all anybody ever told us. And he never talked about it, as is the case with a lot of veterans. Mm-hmm. So it was something that happened, and then right after that, he completely broke down. He went on a holy tear. He grabbed a motorcycle somehow. He kicked in a storefront window. He got in a fight with a prize fighter. They took him in, and right after that, he was hospitalized for 14 months under security. They had to keep him very contained. And that he was on suicide watch while he was there as well. So when he came out, he might have had a good spell. And my parents got married in 47. I was born in 1951. Mm-hmm. And he would be good dad days, bad dad days, but we never knew which of those days were coming up. Mm-hmm. And so one of the advantages of that is I can read a room. I can tell what's going on as soon as I come into a room, because children who grow up in that situation, in that domestic situation, need to know what the weather that day will be at home.
And are you the oldest of your siblings? Or?
I'm the oldest of four. And your previous guest, Representative Munira, being the oldest of nine, I thought, that's a big job.
That's a big job. Yes, I as well am an oldest daughter. You know, there's that oldest daughter thing. But can you talk to me about how the angry outburst impacted you and your siblings? I mean, you just mentioned having to, like, read the room, but it also just makes for a very chaotic childhood.
It does. I never knew which end was up, and things were very unstable. I liked going to school, because I went to Catholic school and I had nuns, and everything was extremely orderly. And things happened when they were supposed to happen, and nobody really messed with the nuns. And it was security for me. And each of my siblings would have a different outlook on this. So I tell in Royal Roots, my memoir, from my perspective. And I talk about them being there, and I felt very protective of them with my dad, who could become violent. And I discovered, I was talking to them about corporal punishment, and I found out I was the only one really spanked and belted of the four, but I was also the mouthiest and the moodiest, the sulkiest. And I would take to my room, I'd leave the dinner table. I would be in my own world of my imagination with my ratting comb and my Aquanet hairspray doing hairdos.
Yes, you retreated into your imagination. And some of our listeners may remember you from your one-woman shows called Hair Theater Beauty School that you performed around the country for about 15 years. So talk to us about how that imagination from your childhood through your adulthood helps you move through life.
I would watch these television shows like I Love Lucy, and I liked the way Lucy wanted to get into show business. I loved show business, and I, in fact, went on a kid's show in Columbus with, I won't say his name because he came to the kid's show after having a martini lunch. And so he they brought him in, actually. They drug him in. And I was talking to him about the contrast between what I saw. I was 5 years old. What I saw at home and what was happening there, and I was driving him absolutely crazy, and he was sweating, and his face got beet red. And by the end of the show, because I really wanted to know how this thing worked, because I wanted to be in my television seeing it, and by the end, the little boy who was on the show with me got a football, and I got a doll case, and I was a town boy. And so I said to him, I'd like a football too. And I think he was going to drop kick me right out of that studio. He had had it.
Oh, man. He's like, I'll show you a football. This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. We're talking with Patricia Wynn Brown, author of the book Royal Roots, Reimagining a Life Through Humor, a Castle, and the U.S. Navy. What made you decide to write a memoir? You know, writing a memoir is a very personal thing. Had you always wanted to write one?
I have always avoided writing about this. And I wrote a humor column for 8 years, and I've written two other books. And when I would go to workshops, the instructor would say, if I'd bring this up, well, that's the story. And I would say, that's the story I can't tell. Because when I was growing up, it was shameful to have a mentally ill person in your family. There was a stigma to that. And people knew my dad was mentally ill. But nobody discussed it with us, and we didn't really discuss it. And all my mom would say is he was in some explosion. And sometimes I wouldn't even know that he had gone to the VA and then how long he'd be there and then come back. So it was a very, very strange thing. But I thought I could help people with this. And I did go through a decision-making process. Because my sibling, my mother's deceased, but my siblings are alive, and I was concerned about that. And I have a son, and I have a grandson, and I have step-grandchildren and cousins. And I thought, I don't know, should I be the one telling this story? But I've been drawn to it, and I'm glad I told it, because during the research, what I discovered through the Freedom of Information Act is exactly what happened to Dad. And we didn't know. And then I went there.
You could see his records?
They sent me 200 psychiatric records, his medical records.
Wow.
200 pages. In some of them in the doctor's own handwriting. And it's immediately after this explosion when he cracked up. So I know now that he was the most disappointed in himself of any of us. Mm-hmm. And he felt worthless. And these are his words throughout. And they describe what happened. But because it happened on a base, not in combat, and because my dad was second of four boys, and his older brother was a war hero. Mm-hmm. He was at Pearl Harbor on the USS West Virginia. He lived. And my grandfather was a cop and eventually chief of police in Columbus. And my father wanted to live up to these ideals. So he was ashamed. It was an explosion and many people were killed. It was a massive of Torpex bombs that are as big as a barrel. 27 of them went off at Norfolk Naval Station. And they were loaded improperly.
It was an accident?
It was an accident. He didn't cause that. He just got off work. He was asleep. But he went out to help with all the dead and the dying. And what we've discovered from the research is combat isn't the only cause of PTSD. So to see mangled bodies, to be among that, to not have been able to save people, that was big. Also, explosions cause brain damage. Mm-hmm. And you could hear this explosion 20 miles away. And he was very near it when he went out of his barracks. So when I went there, the public affairs officer didn't know about this explosion, nor did the commander, Janet Days. So I sent them my research, and they were so kind to me. And at the very end, the commander said, I have something for you. And she handed me a commander coin and said, this is for just a small token of what your dad went through and what your family went through.
Wow. Okay. So you have an upcoming speech that you're doing related,
yes,
to your memoir. Your goal with your upcoming speech and with your memoir is to shed light on this issue, to provide hope to children in military families. So you're calling your talk, With creativity and humor, a child of war finally tells her story. Tell me why you wanted to do this event.
I wanted to share this, particularly at the National Veterans Memorial and Museum in collaboration with Ohioana Library, because children of war, as we're called now, hadn't been receiving a lot of focus. PTSD with the service person is receiving proper focus, but the children also suffer in these families. And a CBS Sunday Morning special just a couple months ago interviewed the children in these families, and usually it's the oldest child who is the one who's trying to hold it all together. So April 9th, it's a free event. There's a suggested donation of $10, if you can, to the StoryCorps project, which is to help children talk to their military families and friends about their own particular relationship with the military person and to ask about their service. But I think it's going to be a wonderful event. And Dr. Greg Alfred from the VA will follow me with what are some of the available services at the VA now. And we'll do a book signing as well.
All right. So this event is April 9th. It's free with free parking as well. And do people need to register?
They should register so we know about seating. It's at 6 o'clock. It won't be, you know, it won't take all your evening, an hour and a half of your evening or so. And you'll be home in time to watch all your programs. But I think you'll find it inspiring. I hope so. Entertaining. There'll be some humor in it because humor heals.
And you are also a longtime volunteer with the Ohio Reformatory for Women, and your memoir is a book club pick for them. Can you tell me how your book, you know, is resonating with their experiences?
Well, before I did a charm school with 11 groups of people, and I'm also associated with Ohio State Medical School, and we do a project with the women at the prison, which is ongoing. And now I started the book club, and we had our first session of the 18 members of the inmates. 9 of these women are vets, former military.
Wow.
And so I told the warden's assistant, Miss Rebecca, and Warden Maldonado has been wonderful to support this, that I hope vets do sign up. They have a vet group there that meets. And so we had our first session, and they are totally interested in this. And we read the prologue, and they talked about how it was resonating with them. So I go back next week for a second. We'll do 4 sessions all together. And it's funded by Harmony Project, which is really wonderful. David Brown and Harmony Project bought the books and supplies for me to take to the prison.
Wow. Do you feel closer to your dad having written this book?
I do. It's been a revelation. It's been redemption. I can see him clearly now. And I put in there, near the end, a story about a man who came up to me at Mass the same Christmas that my dad died in May. And he told me a story about my dad being a little boy, a choir boy. He had a beautiful voice coming into the church, and he was late. And he ran in and he put on his cassock and he put on his surplice. And he ran out to sing. And Mr. McGrail said that your dad had the voice of an angel and he would make the women weep. He said, but the part of the story I want you to know is he had a black eye. He had been in a schoolyard fight and then came in and sang like an angel. And that story has meant the world to me. And finding out what actually happened to him explains everything. It doesn't take away the hurt and the pain that my mother went through and we went through, but it explains what happens with mental illness and how it reverberates through your whole family and causes you to sometimes doubt yourself, sometimes to have shame yourself. But it also motivated me to be very empathic and to help other people.
And we have less than a minute left, but can you tell me about the castle reference in your title?
Yes. In 2011, I discovered this castle in Wales, and it's Gwydir Castle, and it's the ancient Wyn ancestral home. Ireland is all through this thing, but Gwydir. And in the book about it, the writer said, these were the illustrious Wynns. And I thought,
that's you. You're illustrious.
An illustrious Wyn. This just changed. So we had to go there. We went to the the castle. It had magical powers, and I felt pretty royal after that. So I have the royal roots of the mm-hmm. castle, but I have royal roots from my childhood on the hilltop, which I feel very strongly about.
Well, people are going to have to read the book in order to find out. Yes. I want to say thank you, Patricia Wynn Brown, author of the book Royal Roots, Reimagining Life Through Humor, A Castle, and the U.S. Navy. Thank you for joining us.
What a pleasure, Amy. Thank you.
And on April 9th, she'll deliver the keynote address in an event at the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. The event is a part of the Month of the Military Child as well. So thank you. Thank you again for joining us. And what website do you go to register?
You go to the National Veterans Memorial and Museum website to register.
All right. Be sure to that event again is April 9th. This has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.